You're listening to 10,000 Hours. My name is James Ilgenfritz, and my guest is Vinny Golia. So you were born in the Bronx and grew up partly there and then partly in Brooklyn Heights, right? And then
no, I went to, I was born in the Bronx. I moved to New Jersey.
Ah.
And I moved back to New York. And then I started kind of, you know, everybody in the late 70s, I was in their 70s, had wanderlust. You know, you could, you know, get in a van and go someplace else, and if there was a community of like-minded people, you could exist.
Right, yeah.
It was quite different than the paranoia that you have nowadays.
Yeah. Right, indeed. Yeah.
Where, you know, you would never hitchhike unless you had an Uzi with you or something.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what happened in that time period, but which isn't really that long ago, but yeah, that's what I did. And then I tried valiantly to come back to the East Coast a number of times, and then decided that I lived here, so that's fine. And now I make frequent excursions there. For a while, I was in Greg's, like I mentioned, Greg Bendian's band, and with Paul Smoker and and Dresser, when Dresser lived in New York.
All right. Yeah.
And then I was also in, you know, another small group there and played a lot with stuff, and now I play a lot with people from there, back and forth, back and forth.
And you started there playing saxophone in your 20s, right?
Yeah, I was 25 when I started. I thought I was 21 when I started, but it turns out that somebody's corrected me because they actually looked it up and said, like, well, that's not, that can't be. And I said, why not? Because they said, well, 1971 was this many years ago. And I went, oh, God. Okay. I guess you're right. So I started when I was 25. I got a saxophone. Uh-huh. I was working at the Museum of Modern Art. I'd go around and practice there. I met a guy, you know, I was friends with a lot of musicians at the time. And
you started as in visual arts, right?
Yeah,
But you had a lot of musician friends.
Yeah, eventually from going into the clubs and drawing them and using the, then starting on this path of getting towards music notation and such.
Oh, right, yeah, because you said you were painting things to have musicians play, and then they weren't.
Yeah,
they were doing it, but you
couldn't. Yeah, I was using the paintings as a graphic score, but like I just felt like they really, you know, yeah. They weren't doing it the way I heard it, you know.
Right, yeah.
At the Vanguard, one night, in one of the sets, Chick Corea was starting a new trio. So I went down there to draw pictures, but I was sitting too far back. So I started to I was into the music, and I started to see this image. So I kind of sketched out this image on a little thing. And then I went home, and I started painting. I mentioned it to Dave Holland, you know. And he said, oh, I'd like to see it. So he came up to the loft and he saw it. He said, oh, I liked it. I said, thanks. It turns out that he told Chick about it. And Chick said, we'd like to use that picture for our album cover for our new album, because this trio is going to stay together, you know.
Cool.
I said, fantastic. So they paid me some money, and I got the money and went to put it in the bank, and I was working at, like I said, the museum, and at lunchtime I ran down to Manny's music. So I said, do you have any soprano saxophones? So I said, I love that instrument, you know. And they said, yeah, we have one, but there's a guy trying it. So I went back to work, and the guy says, hey, what's up? You look kind of antsy. I said, I saw this saxophone. I really want to buy it. Really? Yeah. He said, take the rest of the day off. Go down there. Well, it was like, you know, 4 o'clock. Mm-hmm. They close at 5:30. And, you know, it's New York, so you're walking.
Right.
You know, okay. I ran down there almost. And it gives me the horn, you know. I take it out, you know. It comes with this mouthpiece, but I can give you a different one. And I said, oh, yeah, I got a Selmer E metal mouthpiece. And he said, what kind of reed do you use? I said, I want Force. That's Rico Rhodes Force. Oh, okay. He said, you want to try it out? And I said, sure. I put it together, you know. I don't know. I don't know anything about this saxophone. Really, I mean, I have no training at all. So I start going, you know? The guy says, hey, do you know how to play at all? I said, no. He said, this is like the best one you could buy. I said, I know what it is. I said, that's why I want it. He said, well, I thought you knew how to play because you asked me so specifically. I said, I want everything Coltrane had. I want a Selmer soprano. I want a Selmer E metal mouthpiece. I want Rico Royal number 4s, and I'll pay you. He said, "Okay, it's your money." And that was
wild.
It. That was it. I took it home, awesome. You know, and I was staying at Dave Liebman's loft, and you know, Liebman showed me like how to put it together and how to, you know, like make the sound and stuff and that was it. I got to see, like, you know, like how to practice and all that kind of stuff, and wow. So I knew what to do.
Right,
you know,
right.
It's like, it's not like any other key thing for me starting so late was like I knew what kind of music I wanted to play.
Makes a big difference.
Yeah. So I could go right to that, and then I filled in the blanks like as I went along, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I started, you know, when you teach yourself, you know, you kind of go to your strengths really fast, you know, right. And then you have to make up the holes, because when you play with other people, that's not their strengths.
Right,
they have
yeah.
their own strengths, and so they're
right,
always, yeah. all your weaknesses are constantly being exposed. You know? That was a very interesting challenge. Still now, it's a challenge, you know, it's like,
right,
but it's kind of fun, actually.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, music has taken me all over the world, and it's given me all these things. Look,
right,
you know,
yeah.
It's like fantastic.
This is an incredible collection of, and these are just like the various like wooden flutes and double reeded things and stuff. I mean,
yeah, this is like, there's Chennai, and then there's all these double reeds are from different places, like That one with the horn on it is more like Azerbaijani type thing. The one behind it is a Zerla from the one in front of it, actually. The one behind it is a Mizrab. That's from Egypt.
Wow.
The one on the one with the brown and the tan is from Indonesia.
Wow.
So is this red one. The one in the middle is from Macedonia, and the one on the end is the big boy from the hills in Bulgaria.
Yeah. Wild.
Yeah.
I didn't realize the pipes tradition was that expansive.
Every country except the United States and Mexico, I think, maybe even some parts of Mexico may have it, but every culture has a bagpipe.
And so you started on the soprano, and then you gradually got to the point of playing, like,
my second instrument was the flute.
Uh-huh.
And I always wanted to play the clarinet. For some reason, when I was a kid, they were going to put me on the accordion. Forget about it. Maybe I played it once, you know. And that was it. From no music, you know. But I listened to music like crazy. My mom would sing in the house. And mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't a musical family, but everybody loved music. My dad loved Dixieland stuff. My mom liked Italian music, the light operas and all that stuff. And also, you know, A&P would have that record a week thing where it'd be like classical favorites. And mom would buy them all, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, yeah, it was interesting. And then Dad worked in the zoo, so I had an exposure to music from different cultures, like I was telling you yesterday.
Right.
So that was all cool, and as I painted more and more and decided that was out what I was going to do, you know, I started buying a lot of records and expanding and stuff like that. You know, as you can see, I like to collect things, so
mm-hmm.
my record company collection was large. And was kind of eclectic, you know.
Uh-huh.
James Brown, I love James Brown, you know. And a lot of those groups, Wilson Pickett would be my second favorite. Otis Redding, all the Motown stuff. And that morphed out of, you know, like the regular R&B stuff, you know, because I was still old enough to catch the tail end of, like, you know, the Platters and all those kind of group, the Coasters. And,
right, yeah.
You know, so, you know.
Nice.
But yeah, so I got a very good overview of music and British invasion and all that, everything,
you know,
which all led to the blues thing, which led to the Indian thing in a strange way. It really did. I don't know how it did, but it did. And then that led to the jazz thing.
Wild.
Hmm. Yeah, strange. With, you know, Coltrane kind of, after I found his music, that kind of like opened up this other door of all this other stuff, you know. It was like, whoa. Yeah. Very curious. I did an experiment in Grand Central Station. I took a small painting and I unrolled it and I put it on the wall and I sat next to it. Uh-huh. Okay, and hardly no one even paid much attention to it. And then I went back another day and I played my saxophone. And now take it for granted that I didn't know what the hell I was doing with the saxophone. You know, and people stopped to listen to it. Uh-huh. And I said, like, okay, sound has much more power than this kind of imagery that you're sticking, just pasting on a wall. It becomes too much part of the environment. Mm-hmm. So you need to create your own environment. So how can you right. create your own environment? So the only thing that you could create your own environment at that time with that was visual was lasers.
Mm, I see.
You know, I mean, you could do it with, like, you could do it with colored light, like Dan Flavin and stuff like that. They're like more installation type things. Uh-huh. But I wasn't really, I was still tied to the idea of it being like where I was, you know, and I'd still be a part of it. It wasn't like right. somebody walking into a space and having their own personal thing, uh-huh. you know. Maybe I'm a control freak, but I wanted to have the, you know what I'm saying?
Right, yeah. It's a shared experience then, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's like a communication cycle,
yeah,
as opposed to just an internal dialogue.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's what I was looking for, and music was much better for me to do that.
Right.
You know, and it took me a while to reconcile that, but when I did, then I was practicing like a mad person.
Yeah, it seems like it must have moved fast. I mean, these records with on the Empire label that you're on, and then the stuff with Braxton in Europe, mm-hmm. that was still in the 70s, so that must have not been too terribly long after you started playing.
I started in 71, so, you know, it's not too long, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, wow, wild.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I had a lot of people who were supportive. I would work construction or do jobs, odd jobs, and save up the money and then not work and practice and then run out of money. I mean, that's what I was doing. I just felt driven that that's what I had to do. And
right. Uh-huh.
So that's the way it went down, and I did put in a lot of time. I mean, I'm sure that doing certain yogic things with breathing and stuff like that accelerated the growth period, you know, and
right,
paying
yeah.
attention to whatever spiritual needs had to be dealt with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, so it was over a short amount of time. But again, like I'm telling you, it's like it's easier to do it if you know what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's much harder to just try to, you know, start playing when you're a kid because your parents tell you to play and you're kind of not right. into it, and you go on and on and on, and then, you know, one day you're kind of like goofing with it. Oh man, I'm 20. I'm 18. I'm 15. I don't really like this instrument. You know, I mean, I like to go outside and go skateboarding or something. You know?
Right. Yeah.
It's a different headspace. Like, it always comes down to like what does inspire you to, you know, like what unlocks the little door.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, it's the same with instruments.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, like, you know, we were talking about Harry Sparney. It's like, and John Sermon yesterday. Well, John Sermon's a good example, and so is Sparney. But so, oh, those instruments can do that. I just thought that could do that. But wow, I know how to use that. You know, you see the use, then you have to learn the instrument.
Right, yeah.
Uh-huh. And it's like a whole other ball game. That's a whole other thing, you know. But it's harder to be the first person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, I'm going to get this, you know, contrabass clarinet and do this with it. Really? Oh, I don't know. Can you do that? I don't know. And then you work on it, and it's like, I'm going to be a multi-instrumentalist who does this. And, really? I mean, usually people are saxophone players who just double. You know, I remember one guy came up to me and said, like, Vinny, you're playing all these horns. Yeah. He said, don't you want to be great? I said, yeah, everybody wants to be great at what they do. Mm-hmm. So, well, yeah, but you're playing too many horns. I said, why can't I be great at playing all these horns? Oh, I don't think you can do that. You know, I'm not saying I achieved that or any of that. Don't get the wrong idea. You know, but I'm just saying, it's like people have this idea of what you should do. I mean, you can't believe what some really great players told me when I started to play music and I decided that that's what I was going to do. Mm-hmm. It was pretty insulting.
Sure. Yeah. Like, I can imagine. You know, like, go back 15 years and start when you're 10 or whatever, you know. It's scary sometimes just to encounter somebody that just has an idea and is willing to just go for it, you know. I mean, because so many people, I mean, it goes against all the ideas about what the rules are that we don't really, we all like to think that we don't really follow rules, but then there's conventional ways of thinking about things that we all subscribe to without realizing it.
Look, at the position I'm in now.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to really watch and bite my tongue sometimes because I want to say, you can't do that. And all of a sudden I go like, what do you mean you can't do that? You can't take that position. It's like, oh, yeah, you're right. I can't take that position because I did something somebody told me I can't do. Right? So, and somebody did the same thing. But, you know, but I can now look at it and say like, okay, avoid the pitfalls of something that I did. I said, why don't you get this happening and, you know, start with the metronome and do this if you want to do that, you know, or you're practicing a lot, but you're practicing incorrectly. Mm-hmm. What do you mean? Well, you're practicing in your comfort zone. You're just playing the same thing over and over. I said, you're memorizing, your fingers are memorizing a certain passage at one tempo. I said, but the thing to do is to push the metronome to where you're uncomfortable.
Right, yeah.
And play it at that place where you're making mistakes so you can overcome the mistakes and get a greater range of different tempo you can play in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, just that's a basic thing, you know? Right. But there are people, you know, kids that come and they say, like, oh, this is, you know, you go like, okay, let's not look at why he can't do it. Let's see, what can we give him, what information can we give him to help him do it? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think if more people took that position, we wouldn't have as much of the hatred we have in the world as now, because everybody be working on stuff they want to try rather than being frustrated about stuff they can't do.
Right, yeah.
You know?
So you've started to take the approach of collecting music written for like instruments, you know, sort of a whole set of pieces for multiple clarinets and a whole set of pieces for E-flat woodwinds and a whole set of pieces for B-flat woodwinds and a whole set of pieces for flutes. Mm. And, you know, with nice combinations of players and everything. Mm. When did you start sort of developing this idea? Like, which was the first one of those that you did?
Well, I always wanted to do... I remember telling Nels and Alex. I said, I want to have a CD kind of soloistic of all the instruments that I do. Like, each one would be like, you know, each instrument would have its own project. Mm-hmm. And they were like, well, Vinny, that's really ambitious. I was like, well, you know, maybe so, but, you know. Okay, so I've been thinking about it for a long time. I was here at school, and I wanted to try some of this music I wrote for something, and we couldn't find, you know, like a rhythm section or something. And then I just had, there were saxophone players, and I said, hey, let's play this. Can you guys play this for me? I just want to hear it, you know? And so it sounded really neat. So I started thinking about it, and they were all like students of mine. I said, I'm going to start doing this now. So I wrote a couple more pieces. This is really cool. I can use a lot of the instruments I never get to play. What, you know, like, cause most of the time I have to play them in these little settings where it's just me or somebody. Mm-hmm. But I can create, you know, I mean, like John Carter with his octets, he created a new environment for the clarinet to be the featured instrument. Mm-hmm. I thought, like, wow, that's what I have to do. I have like contrabass clarinet. Okay, I have to write a piece where that instrument isn't buried in the background, but like supported by these other instruments that usually overpower it, or right. something like that. You know,
is that sort of how you? I mean, you've got such a highly developed style of writing that incorporates intuitive melodic elements, but then works so well with improvisation in terms of kind of being a seamless integration and everything. Is that kind of where you started writing more? Or, I mean, like, when did you start composing for ensembles and things?
Well, I think, like, around 81, the writing took a big leap. I mean, it's been in spurts. Like, okay, so, you know, at the beginning, I thought everybody wrote their own music. I mean, I knew there were people played standards and stuff, but most of that wasn't the area I was interested in. So most of the people that I knew wrote their own music. Uh-huh. So when I started in different groups, I would have an idea for a piece and try and figure out how to write it and stuff. Uh-huh. And then when I started with playing in the smaller group, then I started writing a little bit, but music was okay. And then after the first record, I felt like, oh, I'm going to have Bikita Carroll on the second one. I better write something good because he plays with Julius. And I started thinking about Julius's music. And, you know, Julius writes in such a way that, and Bikita was talking and explaining like how the harmony part somehow morphs to the melody part. And it's like this, he writes through the staves. So that so that made me curious, and I started to try to do that. So around 81, I finally got to a point where I did something like that. Mm-hmm. And then I started pursuing that more. And in 82, I did the first large ensemble. And with that project, Wayne Pete helped orchestrate and do stuff because I wasn't really on top. You know, I didn't have any training for that. Mm-hmm. But I heard what I wanted, and then I would try and figure stuff out, and then he and I would sit at the piano, and I basically play through all the parts I wrote and kind of harmonize them until we agree on something. I'd say, oh, that's really nice, I like that. Mm-hmm. What's that, you know? And then eventually I taught myself how to do that. 82 was a good spot. And then when Kenny joined the group in 84, when I started playing with him, that was another quantum leap, because now you had a bass player who could really play like a counterpoint line. So that opened up a whole area of new writing.
Right, yeah.
And Then in, I would say around 1990 or 91, I took over writing and arranging and orchestrating all the music for the large ensemble.
I see.
Yeah. And then after that, then it was actually coming here later in the 90s and coming here where I started writing for the groups, like writing my own book constantly. Mm. And I started to get really good. And then I got three ensembles. So I write a new book for each ensemble every semester.
Wow, crazy.
It's because like one semester you might get, like one semester the large group that I have here had two guitars and two tubas. Mm-hmm. So
you got to use that.
Yeah. So all the music was based around this kind of hocketing rhythm.
Nice.
Things, you know. And then another year, like we had, like this, like last year, we had a really great brass section. Mm-hmm. So most of the music was written around the brass section. It's kind of like a re-examination of all the stuff. And so you're constantly writing for different challenges, you know. It's kind of like a New Age Hindemith, you know, where you're writing right. something new every week, you know.
Right.
And then on top of that, my own groups have started to use more and more of the people who have graduated from school. So mm-hmm. it's like a lot more of the younger players because they're quite virtuosic mm-hmm. and they don't complain. and they like to travel and they like to play and they like to show mm-hmm. their shit, you know?
Right.
So it's been really lovely for me because mm-hmm. I can write the hardest crap in the world and the guys will complain a little bit and then play it, you know?
Right.
It's really wonderful. The problem is you can't go someplace else and do it, you know. I mean, I can't always bring the charts out right here to like New York and have people just kind of pick them up, you know, and do it, you know.
Fortunately, you do have Kenny there, so.
I do have Ken. That's fantastic. And Nate Woolley's really good. He did a great job the last time we played.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, before the sextet I had now, I had this group with Chris Steiner mm-hmm. called Jazz for Models. you know, we played, the music wasn't as complex because those cats were more into the blowing aspects of the music and stuff. Uh-huh. We almost kind of like felt it together more than played it metrically. Mm-hmm. And this group that I have now, I really wanted to get more away from that 4/4 swingish thing. I still do it, but, you know, more towards like vamps and cycles mm-hmm. and stuff like that.
Right, yeah.
And with this band now, I mean, it's pretty good with that kind of stuff.
You're cool. Speaking of, you know, bringing your music to New York, mm. you're bringing quite a lot of your music to New York soon. Is that sextet?
Yeah,
one of
they
those
are
things?
Playing actually. Cool. We're great. Playing one of those teens. I can't remember 13 or 14. I'm there from the 1st to the 15th. Well, I'm not there. I mean, I'm playing a number of times in different things, but I guess John had the idea of having all these different labels booked in.
Right, yeah.
The nights, yeah.
Yeah, so Nine Winds and trying
Ecstatic
to remember what
Peace
else.
Ecstatic Peace is doing one. Cryptogramophone is doing later in the year.
Yeah. And it'll be nice to see, I mean, so it's like a lot of different projects of yours, but then also some of the groups on Nine Winds, right?
Yeah, a lot of them are on Nine Winds, like... Well, Nels is on a lot of projects, uh-huh. and Ken. Mm-hmm. Harris Eisenstadt has, I mean, he's on a lot of labels, but he has one on Nine Winds.
Yeah, I have that one. It's a large group, too.
Yeah, right? a large group. Yeah. Then Dan Rosenblum, myself, Dr. Mint, a couple of people that I play with who were from out here, like Adam Lane. Mm-hmm. Oh, Mia Masaoka.
Well, it'll be exciting to have you performing so many times right in our backyard.
I don't know if it'll be exciting, but I'm going to do it anyway. It'd be nice to be back home for a little while.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Vinny, thanks. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Yeah. Thanks for asking. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been 10,000 Hours. My name is James Ilgenfritz, and my guest has been Vinnie Golia.